does managing high blood pressure reduce diabetes risk?
A new type of blood thinner.
Is there a better way to assess someone's heart disease risk?
And COVID vaccine, a new one? And should it be given with the flu vaccine?
That's what we're talking about this week on Double T Health Watch, your weekly look at the medical headlines from Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso. I'm Elizabeth Tracy, a Baltimore-based medical journalist.
And I'm Rick Lang, president of Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso, where I'm also dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine.
And Rick, we're treating two studies that are in The Lancet together today, the ones that you served up as, should we give the flu vaccine and the COVID vaccine simultaneously, and a new type of COVID vaccine?
Which you want to cover first?
Whichever you'd like.
Okay, well, let's talk about the new vaccine first. The country of India has developed their own vaccine. It's a whole virion inactivated virus vaccine. Almost 26,000 participants were randomly assigned in this double-blind study to receive either their vaccine called BBV-152 or placebo, and they studied the efficacy. It's pretty effective. When they looked at the number of cases, 0.3% of those that received the vaccine developed COVID versus 1.2% of those that developed placebo. That's an efficacy of about 78%. And the efficacy in preventing asymptomatic infection was about 2/3. And by the way, it doesn't require the extreme cold storage as some of the other vaccines.
That's great news. I think it's also great news that India is creating its own vaccine. I think that we have a big problem with the limitations relative to manufacturing of vaccines. And I think the more countries that get into this game, the better we're all going to be.
Yeah. And kudos, by the way, for developing the vaccine and also proving in a very good trial that it is, in fact, effective and just about as effective as the other vaccines available.
I think the other thing that is going to be interesting to see is going to be the long-term immunogenicity, if you will, of this particular strategy.
I'm glad you mentioned, Elizabeth. Again, this is two doses. Many of the vaccines were tested prior to the Delta variant. This was effective not only in the non-Delta variants, but also in the Delta variants as well. And just as effective in older and younger people, people that had comorbid conditions, not only is it effective, but it's also safe. Percentage of individuals that had side effects with the vaccine as did with placebo, by the way, and no serious side effects. We need to test it in millions.
Which I don't think you're going to have any trouble doing. So let's turn to this issue that's a big domestic issue. Heard lots of people talking about it. Should you get your flu vaccine and a COVID vaccine at the same time?
This was a very well-conducted study that looked at two different vaccines, the adenoviral vaccine and mRNA vaccine, with three different types of flu shots. Flu shots in older individuals, they need a higher flu dose. That's a quadrivalent. They have the usual flu vaccine, and there's also one that has something that's supposed to make it more immunogenic called an adjuvant. So they tested in six different groups over almost 700 individuals, the two COVID vaccines and these three different flu vaccines in various combinations to say, hey, is it safe? So in this group of individuals, I said six different groups, different combinations with the flu given on the second dose of the COVID vaccine, what they established is that it is safe. There are no more side effects associated with either of the COVID vaccines or any of the flu vaccines. And they're also just as effective in producing an immune response. We don't want to put up barriers. And so if individuals know they can get the COVID vaccine and the flu vaccine at the same time, that takes the barrier out of the way.
It sure does. It should facilitate lots of people being able to get in there and get it done.
Absolutely. Now, what I would tell people is they should be given in different arms, again, safe and efficacious.
So since we're talking about safe and efficacious, let's turn, we're still in The Lancet, to something that is really quite interesting, this notion that if we treat high blood pressure, we can actually stave off new onset type 2 diabetes. This is not a new idea, and this study is a meta-analysis, what they call a one-stage individual participant data meta-analysis, looking at this risk of new onset type 2 diabetes in folks who are being treated for high blood pressure. They had over 145,000 participants from 19 randomized trials, median follow-up of 4.5 years. What they basically found was systolic blood pressure reduction by 5 millimeters of mercury reduced the risk of type 2 diabetes across all these trials by 11%. The two types of blood pressure meds that were able to do this were angiotensin-converting enzyme or ACE inhibitors and ARBs, angiotensin II receptor blockers. They both were able to reduce the risk of type 2 diabetes. It turns out that calcium channel blockers, however, had no impact, and beta blockers and thiazide diuretics, so first-line treatment for hypertension, actually increased the risk. So what's this say to you?
So there's probably some link between hypertension and development of type 2 diabetes. I know that hypertension increases sympathetic nerve activity, increases inflammation, and it may affect insulin resistance. It's also important to note that it is somewhat of a class effect, targeting specific medications. So those people that are considered to be at risk for type 2 diabetes, targeting blood pressure medications that include ACE inhibitors or ARBs is important. And those that are a higher risk would probably want to avoid thiazides or beta blockers. The interesting thing is most individuals aren't treated with just one blood pressure medicine. It's oftentimes two or three. So this study didn't assess what the combination of those things would be.
I guess the other thing I'd like to see would be following up people who start on diuretics, which as we know is what most people start on, and see, well, okay, what happens to diabetes incidence when people start on that?
Yep. When one looked at individual classes of medications, thiazide diuretics, it's known to increase the risk of glucose intolerance or insulin resistance just a bit. We do know, however, in a population that is elderly with systolic hypertension, they're tolerated well, they're effective, they lower the risk of cardiovascular events, there are few side effects. And so it's oftentimes one of the first go-to medications in the older population. So those that aren't considered to be at risk of diabetes, the thiazide diuretics can still be very useful, but oftentimes they're used with other medications.
More to come, no doubt. Let's turn to the New England Journal of Medicine, the prevention of a serious problem, venous thromboembolism.
We see venous thromboembolism in a lot of different conditions, but one of the ones we see is people that have had hip or knee surgery. And this are represented as a new class of blood thinners. And we know that individuals that are born with what's called a factor 11 deficiency have a decreased risk of having venous thromboembolism, but they don't bleed very much. That natural occurrence said, well, gosh, maybe if we made an inhibitor to factor 11, we could get the same results. We need something that's given orally. So this is the study of a new factor 11 inhibitor that can be given orally. So they tested it in people that are having knee surgery versus a known medication that we already give that we know was effective. So in over 1,200 patients, they gave half of them this new factor 11 inhibitor called milvexian. And what they found out, it was just as effective in preventing clots. It was less likely to cause clinically relevant bleeding than the current anticoagulant or blood thinner that we're using.
This is really good news. This was just a phase 2 trial though, wasn't it?
It was. And what they discovered is that there's dose-dependent efficacy. The higher the dose, the more effective, but the higher dose didn't increase the risk of bleeding.
No doubt. Well, this is excellent news for all those folks who have to have these kinds of meds after they have joint replacement.
Yeah, kudos to our scientists that aren't resting on the laurels saying, gosh, we have enough blood thinners and they're fine. We're always looking for a better one and a safer one.
Finally, let's turn to JAMA Cardiology. We should note that we have all of these publications relative to cardiovascular disease that are also being released because of the American Heart Association meeting. As we know, when we're trying to manage somebody's lipids, we rely on this low-density lipoprotein and to a lesser degree to triglycerides. And what this study basically says is, wait a second, there's a better way to do this. And apparently this has been an ongoing controversy, which I was unaware of. So tell me, Rick, you must have been aware of this.
I was. We've known for a long time that cholesterol is associated with a higher risk of cardiovascular disease, but more importantly, it's different types of cholesterol. The low density lipoprotein, LDL cholesterol, associated with the increased risk. Definitely a high density lipoprotein with a decreased risk. It's not really the cholesterol, it's what it's attached to, the lipoprotein. In this particular case, it's called an ApoB lipoprotein. We've known about this for years. Instead of measuring all these cholesterols, maybe what we need to do, because the number of cholesterols can kind of increase or decrease, but the number of ApoB particles may be a little bit more predictive. And by the way, it's easy to measure, it's easier to understand, and it looks like the ApoB proteins go up and down with statin therapy or lifestyle, things like that.
So they had two prospective cohort analyses that they had two large international clinical trials, and the UK-based Biobank. Almost 400,000 folks in the primary prevention group and over 40,000 who were receiving statin treatment. Basically, what they found out was that this measurement, ApoB, was absolutely the thing to be looking at. And I would note that clinical laboratory standards do show that it can be measured effectively and reliably.
It's the ApoB protein that actually gets trapped in the arteries that causes this atherosclerotic process. It's all in the ApoB protein. So these authors have said, listen, we've been getting this data for a number of years in different ways, and now it's time just to change how we think about things. Finally, we ought to say, listen, we're just going to measure your ApoB.
Well, if you were a betting guy, how many years would you say it's going to take before patients are going to be up to speed on ApoB?
Now, I think it's probably going to be about 5 years. So I would suggest if the physicians get on board, we start teaching the medical students and we start reporting about what the ApoB levels are and how they're lowered with statin.
Okay, that's a look then at this week's medical headlines from Texas Tech. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all listen up and make healthy choices.